I refuse to talk about the first 10 years.
There you go. Well, that's what they want to know.
What happened the first 10 years?
Not good. Well, County Agent MP Pinkerton made the statement that the land was so dry and so poor that a crow had to carry its lunch to get across, you know, central Wisconsin.
Welcome to Profile Central Wisconsin, a podcast about the origins of the organizations that make our community thrive. I am Benjamin Nuss, your co-host and the campus dean of Mid-State Technical College's Stevens Point campus. On this episode of Profile, Todd and I have the pleasure to be joined by two members of the Wysocki family, enterprising founder, Louis, along with his business-savvy son and current CEO, Russell. As always, this episode starts with some history, but given the privileged opportunity to interview Louis, we take a deeper dive into some history of our community. He shares how the Wysocki family went from plowing an 80-acre field with a car to now tending to over 25,000 acres with high-tech precision equipment. Louis' efforts not only grew the family farm, but empowered the greater distribution of Wisconsin potatoes throughout the country. Because of his leadership roles in numerous trade organizations, Louis was recently recognized as one of the 50 most innovative and influential individuals in the industry by Potato Grower magazine. However, the Wysocki family of companies is more than just a produce farm. They also include a separate entity for storage, processing, and packaging called Paragon Potato Farms, and one for sales and marketing called RPE. As the current CEO, Russell will share with us his vision for the future and how they plan to use water conservation and solar energy to take a leading role in sustainable operations. Here's the story of the Wysocki family of companies from Louis and Russell.
My father was the youngest one out of a family of 10. His parents were pretty industrious, came from Poland as a young man, apparently a good businessman. He wasn't very tall, a little over 5 feet, but he was well respected in the community, signed for a lot of people to come across from Europe. Then the Depression hit. He had his neighbors and his friends from Europe here. He couldn't do nothing about that. And so there was the equivalent of a tractor dealership, you know, horses here in Stevens Point. That was the only place you could get credit. They'd take a mortgage on a farm. Something happened to the horse. They had the farm, and they owned pretty near all the farms from Stevens Point up 66 to Rushelt. My grandfather was a victim of that because he couldn't deal with his people that he signed for here. They couldn't pay him. He couldn't pay his bills. And so when Prohibition was voted out, there was a empty building. My dad opened it up as a bar.
Yeah.
Actually, it was called Pullen Corners originally.
Pullen Corners.
Yeah. And then there was got to stay out of those kind of history. There was a big fight over the location of the Polonia Church, too close to the bars, and they moved to Polonia. But anyway, his father lived to be 94. He wound up staying home and basically had to care for that. His mother had died quite a few years before. He stayed in the tavern until the year I graduated from high school in 1953. And he turned the tavern over to my sister. And that's when we started to call it full-time farming, if you want. Prior to that, he ran the bar and he bought cucumbers for a pickle company in Milwaukee, Jewett and Sherman Company. He made some money after the war in the late 40s, you know, when things opened up. But you got to remember, it was the Depression, then the war, and times were pretty tough.
So he was selling pickles? Was he pickling or was he just selling cucumbers?
Cucumbers, and then they turned them in. They went to Iola to a pickle plant that put them in brine, and then they wound up in it's a Jewett and Sherman Company in Milwaukee. Mm-hmm. It's a good company to do business with. So he had some experience in farming. He actually was watering the cucumbers on probably like about 5 acres with a small pump. The only job I've had was cutting ice on the river over here for $1 an hour in spring of 1954.
Wait a sec. You used to cut ice on the river?
For the railroad, for Soo Line Railroad.
So that it would be just to transport ice before refrigeration?
Well, for loading the boxcars.
Yeah.
You know, that held tarsholes. We cut here that winter. It's kind of dangerous work. Those blocks of ice weighed about 250 pounds. about twice what I weighed at that time. It was tough work cutting the channel, or cutting the blocks loose. Once you got the initial blocks cut, then you could break them off and float them and go into conveyor and go into a truck. And a beer distributor here had the contract, so to speak. And then from here, we went to Fond du Lac and cut there for about 2 weeks. And local farmers were, for winter job, were hiring out. We had about 120 acres at that time, my dad had, in three different locations, small fields. We bought a neighboring farm. It was right next to the terminal moraine. It was just the first time I put a plow on the ground there. I couldn't believe it. We never should have bought it. We never should have succeeded. We could load a platform dump truck with rocks, picking them by hand, without moving the truck. And that
the rocks are still there, by the way. We're still picking.
Yeah, well, they turned out because you brought a lot of them in with the potatoes and picked them and all that. At that time, land was $75 an acre. We paid a premium for that one. It had a very fairly new dairy barn on it. And we had, when my dad was in the tavern, we milked about 8 cows. The ones that went to high school did the milking. We weren't dairymen. My dad would care for them. They were sick or something like that. I don't recall him ever milking a cow. And I don't recall making any money when just the high school kids were doing that. One caveat of that was that if there was something going on in the barn, we could miss the bus and we could take the car to school, and that would happen fairly often. So, much you could do about that. But that's, my brother Francis was 2 years behind me. He graduated in 1955. He had never worked out any place. The only place I ever worked out was a month and a half cutting ice on the river here. I got married in 1957, but we really struggled. We had absolutely nothing but sweat equity. None of us, my youngest brother was 11 years younger than me. He's the only one that had a new jacket to wear to high school. The rest of us wore my dad's old hunting clothes. You shouldn't have made it and doing that. Fortunately, irrigation came into this community in the early 50s. I can remember standing with Norman Marzella from Marzella and Sons by the gymnasium in P.J. Jacobs, and they were having a hearing on whether you could pump water or not. People are saying that the water is going to all go disappear, just like the trees did during early logging days. That hasn't happened, and still hasn't happened. The last couple of years really tells you a different story.
You remember early 50s, those initial conversations about bringing irrigation to this area?
Well, they were having this hearing. It was a legislative hearing, and they held it here in central Wisconsin at the gymnasium. And they were taking testimony, and Norm and I were standing there. They were asking if anybody else wanted to testify, and I strode up there and testified.
Do you remember what you
said? As a senior in high school. For me, I've been involved in issues, all my life.
Do you remember, Louis, what you said at that hearing?
I think I told them that was the future. A young man like me, that was going to be our future.
Prophetic.
If you go back in history in Portage County, you probably have seen this, where there was a trial of the errant bull. It was a county agent was trying to get them introduce A1 breeding to farmers, and he held it, had the local judge right on the square. That's where all the commerce took place. There was no local market. It was peddlers that sold directly to grocery stores and picked up potatoes, and people would bring in on sleighs and then in pickup trucks, and then they would accumulate them, and then they'd put them on a boxcar or something like that and ship them. County agent M.P. Pinkerton made the statement that, the land was so dry and so poor that a crow had to carry its lunch to get across, central Wisconsin. But they call that trial the trial of the errant bull, and they condemned it to poor offspring and poor genetics and poor milk and all that. But if you look back in history now, the same argument about new technology, people resist that kind of technology, was held over with the introduction of alfalfa, the silo, milking machine, A1 breeding. They were all the same arguments that you hear now with bovine growth hormone, generated mostly by fear of losing a market. That's a brief history where that was at. We struggled. I can remember pulling a drag in a field with a car. didn't have any tractors, anything like that. And gearboxes weren't yet like you see on motors. A machine shop in Rushelt that would modify the gear from a Maytag wash machine, that you could make a gear reduction box with it instead of belts and pulleys.
So just to be clear, you'd take apart washing machines in order to operate your vehicles.
You had to do a little machining for a bearing, and then you drove it with a belt and that, but that gave you a reduction. You didn't have like Dayton Motors with gear reduction like you got today.
Ben, this seems like it surprises you.
Things have changed.
So back in the 50s when you were just starting at the dairy farm, and was it like survival mode? And then did you at some point switch into it being more of a business?
There was no fertilizer or irrigation pipe till after Second World War. The Crogwells and Amherst Junction were the first ones to irrigate with a steam engine, with a belt driving an old pump next to a creek with cast iron sewer pipe.
But you started finally having success would be realistically in the late 60s, early 70s is when Waisaki Farms finally started to get productive and become more of a business than growing it from that standpoint, if I recall.
Well, these brick houses that you see, the two-story brick houses, every one of those was designed to store potatoes in a basement. And then you'd sort them from here and pick out the bad ones and put the good ones over there next. Now all the bad ones were fed for the pigs and back and forth. And whatever you had left, then you came, brought them into town and sold. And that was about it. As a young man, I felt that they were controlled by that. And when I was 17, I was hauling potatoes to Milwaukee and buying them here and hauling to Milwaukee. And then I gravitated into, about the time I was 20, hauling into Chicago. I asked a merchant in Chicago, I says, how come you pay us less FOB than you pay the farmers in Idaho FOB? He says, because you're closer to us. I trucked till 1960. I was pretty observant of what went on and what was going on. And you go to South Watermacker in Chicago at 2 o'clock in the morning, it was just live. A guy could walk from here to there to make a sale. And he'd get a little book to mark it down, and then somebody else, they'd load the truck or something like that. And the language was terrible.
Don't share that.
So paint this picture. So in the late 50s, you're collecting potatoes here, driving them down to Chicago, and selling them at an open market?
You didn't have places like Cisco at that time.
Mm-hmm.
Every town had a warehouse that supplied grocery stores and all that.
Mm-hmm.
But the grocery stores were small. They were usually in conjunction with a local tavern in rural areas or something like that. That's, they'd sell some hardware stuff. I can take you to Polonia right now and get you some square nails. They're still in the bin in Sylvia's. Every place had a produce house. Right by the river was here to Yale Shafton Company that would buy produce, get it either shipped in or buy local produce, or kind of like the square, only a little, that was more formal. But then along came technology, and along came the Ciscos and those, and they put all of those places out of business. And what happened during that period of time, they hung on as long as they could. The business practices were not very great. You had to be pretty red-blooded to be in that business. It was exciting.
So why did you make the choice to incorporate with your brother Francis and Greg?
Well, that was the show ownership.
Mm-hmm.
We were equal partners with my dad.
Mm-hmm.
He kept his land out. That was his 401k.
Sure.
Most farmers' 401k is their land.
Mm-hmm.
The land that we paid $125 an acre for back in 1958 is now $6,500 an acre. Pickups were $1,500, now they're $40,000.
Do you remember when you incorporated how many acres?
My dad had 50 acres of muckland. It came with a barn, and we increased it to about 35 cows. I never had a real love of that. I guess when I look back, that was kind of mild to me. I liked more excitement than that. And the produce business was very, very exciting. It's a very good business. It's kind of like the stock market.
Mm-hmm.
Irrigation had come in right about the same time that as I was graduating from high school. And that's when deep wells first came in. The first well, first self-propelled one in was right next to our farm. When you got about 100 ponds to an acre. That would be across a quarter mile. It would be about 10 100-pound bags is what you'd get. Immediately when you could put water on, even didn't have to be very finite about it, just splash it on, it went to 200-bag staker. Hmm. There was no fertilizer until after the Second World War. So there was a lot of opportunity that came then. We did a lot of land clearing. That's how we acquired land. We could expand as you could afford to expand. I managed in such a way that we basically refinanced every year. And I would price the land and I'd take it to the bank. I was capitalizing on the increased value of land.
Just to be clear, each year your land value would go up. That would allow you access to more capital.
With inflation and also with production. Today, to be able to get financing, and you can get it, it's available now much broader than it was, but you have to show profitability. It isn't based on what you're worth. It's based on what the money's going to do, and they expect to have it paid back every year, kind of line of credit type of thing. So that's how that's transitioned over the years.
So I can relate this to my own history. I've lived in Wisconsin for a long time, but I grew up in South Dakota, surrounded by corn and beans and cows. In many ways, your heritage is much like mine. My great-grandparents emigrated from Germany, yours from Poland. They farmed for many years, but no longer farm that land anymore. And I think that many families have this kind of story where small farms went away, but not the case for Waisaki, right? What kind of separated you in that you were able to persist for all these years?
The difference between that and vegetable farming, I guess that would be the thing, is that you had a lot more opportunity and control in vegetable farming. How well you could do, how good you could grow, how well you could market, how industrious you were, and all these kind of things.
What was it for you? Was it cleverness? Was it agronomy? Was it your ability to drive to Chicago and market? What do you think set you apart?
So from a standpoint of why our farm was able to make it past that next edge of being a small farm and how did we continue to grow, I would tell you is tremendously amount of perseverance and just pure hard work. It was pure not going to quit. Between my dad and Francis and Greg, there was not an answer. We're going to get it done. We're going to make it happen. And probably even more than anything that I think we're most proud of today is the family business. Mm-hmm. And so there's 30 owners within the Waisaki family of companies. There's 17 of us still working there as owners and family members within the company. One thing that Dad always pushed for and that his leadership was is keep the wealth together as a group. Mm-hmm. And you see so many farms and so many families that have broken up because the brothers or the wives or the in-laws or whatever happens got into an argument and spat and they couldn't figure out how to make it better. And so what they did instead is they split up the farm into two and then you couldn't compete anymore. And the one thing, even though all families have challenges and we've had plenty of our own, we always said we're going to do what's right and we're going to do what's right for the business. And therefore, the family's been able to stay together. And we've the structure that he talks about his father putting in, Louis and Francis put in for us in an immense amount of way. We've always had rules. There was a buy-sell agreement before I was 15 years old, and we were going to make sure that everybody understood the rules. And as long as you understood the rules, it was really hard to have a fight because the fight got ended, right? Because here's what's going to happen if you do.
Yeah, Louis described it as a 401k, right? Your land, and when it gets passed on, it's de facto an inheritance. And
right.
If it can't get split because of an agreement you have ahead of time, it makes it stronger. And
so we're looked upon as a corporate farm, and we're a very large farm. Nobody's trying to say that we're not. We have 400 families that we employ and people there, and we have 25,000 acres. But if you split that amongst the 30 of us, it's really not as much as it would be from that standpoint. We're really a fortunate group from that standpoint. There's six of my generation that now own the company that are running the operating company, but yet we still have the 30 that own the land holding company and we rent it from them and it works very well. And we had a way of earning that opportunity. It was never a right, I can guarantee you. There was an opportunity that was given to us and you had to cut mustard in order to make it and show that you were worthy of running a business. And I think those expectations, rather than giving us an opportunity that we would fail at, it was more of a challenge to succeed at.
In a sense, it was never given. It had to be earned.
It's still not. No, I'm joking. But, you know, it was always expectations. I mean, well enough was not good enough. There's always could be done better. And we have always challenged ourselves, how can we do it better? That was always the rule, and never be satisfied with just success of yesterday. If we're guilty of anything, which we are in that and many things, but is we don't celebrate our successes as well as we challenge ourselves to make sure that we do a better job next year or next crop.
What were some of the landmarks in your growth?
So in 1971 is when I would say that Louis and Francis finally decided that they needed to take care of their direction. So they started what was now RPE. So that was a sales company. So this is our 50th year. It's interesting. We just figured that out actually by looking up some old numbers. We didn't even pay attention to ourselves. So it's kind of comical that shows you this refinancing every year. That part wasn't important to us. It's always looking forward, not looking backward. But in 1971 is when we started the sales company so that we had control of our future. So that therefore, whatever the crop was grown and then packed, we had a place for it. And by doing that, he really started the opportunity of sales rather than just trucking. He had control of the customer. And the old rule always was he who has the order to let is king. There you go. I've heard that my whole life and I screwed it up. Sorry.
So it's true.
By doing that, it gave us that opportunity to have a place for our market. And today I'm really proud of that because 95% of the potatoes we sell to the person who writes the final check. And to me, that's critically important because you take out away all those other expenses and then you can grow your business and have control.
What does RPE stand for?
It used to be Russet Potato Exchange.
Okay.
But it originally started out as Sharon Farms, and then it started as Waisaki Sales, and then it started as Russet Potato Exchange. So it was really interesting. When I came into marketing in 1983, when I graduated high school, I did some stints in the sales office. I was always going to be in sales. We were Waisaki Farms, and we were being a family. Well, back then, believe it or not, in the 80s, the customers didn't want you to be that. They wanted you to be a business. So then, therefore, we came up with Russet Potato Exchange because that was what was done. And it's interesting. It's come full circle. Now everybody wants to buy from the family business. So now do we change our name back or do you leave it as RPEs? But it's a really a change marketplace from the 1980s and 90s from that standpoint.
I'm going to a little different slant on that is that we adapted to the changes that were out there. The real reason between Russet Potato Exchange, Idaho was the potato, had the advertising, were there and they had the water. Today, you can't find an Idaho in a local grocery store. You can find them on your plate in a white tablecloth restaurant. Because today, the varieties that you've got and other things like that, the freight rates and those kind of things, some of the biggest advents that helped change things in our industry is before you had Eisenhower put in the interstate highway system. When I was going in the early 50s, to Chicago is an 8-hour trip. You stopped at every stop sign in Amherst Junction, basically. Everyone in Fond du Lac, everyone in Oshkosh, everyone in West Bend, everyone on Highway 100. And you wore your foot out. I had a board on a steel foot feeder because your bottom of your foot would get so hot. But today it's 3 hours. That's how much the country struck. You didn't have refrigeration. So potatoes were basically grown up until like March, came out of the northern tier states. And then they went to Florida and California. California had a big part of the market. And they were the only supplier during that period. Today, California potatoes almost unknown. Today, we have potatoes year-round. Refrigeration, interstate highway, and irrigation changed the world for everybody. We took advantage of that. We structurally did some. The reason for Russet Potato Exchange was because I called it Russet Potato Exchange because some of the customers were saying, why are you buying from a dealer, you know, when it was Waisaki Sales? We want you buying directly from the farmer. So the opportunity was called Exchange, so we were like the co-op that were selling for everybody. And the boxes we sold in to get into the Idaho market said Russet on it as many times as I possibly could. Russet Potato Exchange, Russet Potatoes.
More from Louis and Russell in a moment. Just a quick break to share some brief announcements. The summer term starts on May 24th, so be sure to visit msdc.edu to learn about all of the programs that are starting soon. If you're just looking to take a class or two, visit msdc.edu/summer and choose from over 130 classes with online options and transfer to UW schools available. Our summer continuing education catalog is also now available, so if you're looking to pick up a quick skill or two, see all that we have to offer. In addition to connecting businesses, the Portage County Business Council provides networking opportunities for the next generation of community leaders through Ignite Young Professionals. To learn more about Ignite, visit portagecountybiz.com. That's biz with a Z. Now, let's hear more of the story of the Wysocki family of companies. Wysocki is really a family of companies. Wysocki Produce Farm, Paragon Potato Farms, and then RPE, which we discussed earlier. Can you kind of differentiate all of these and tell us the origin stories of maybe each company?
So the Wysocki Farms was the first. So that's where Dad cut his teeth. That's where we built the farm. Back in the 80s, we were about a 3,500 to 4,000 acre farm, and we've grown that from that sense. We own a total of 16, 17,000 acres now, but we're farming and renting close to 25,000 acres of farm. And that is run by my partner, Jeff Summers. So we also have an interesting partnership group. So yes, it's Wysocki family of companies, but Jeff Summers is a non-family member, but it's been a family friend and neighbor for my whole life. He's a year younger, was my cousin, Bill Wysocki. One of our partners, he was his roommate in college and best friend in high school. And so we've continued to do that. My brother, Gary and Jim, and then we have Kirk Willie, who is my brother-in-law. So it's a family of companies, and we treat each other like family and brothers, I guess, at this time. And so Wysocki Farms was that building block that we had. And then in the Paragon packaging plant started in late 70s, and it was a partnership between Plover River Farms, Nick Summers. He had a small packaging plant. We had a small packaging plant, wasn't able to be efficient, wasn't able to be competitive in the marketplace. And Louie and Nick were able to get together and basically join, and we put them all into one. And it allowed us to do a couple things. It allowed us to expand the packaging plant, be more efficient for our customers. At the same time, Nick needed more land, so he took over some of our land in the Ellis area as the time that we then expanded down into the Plainfield-Bancroft area. So every time that we found a piece of property, Nick would buy one of ours, we'd move out there, and it gave us both an expansion opportunity that we wouldn't have had any other way. And Paragon got to be a much bigger facility and the largest packaging facility within the state of Wisconsin at the time. Now that we had a big fire in October 2nd of 1999, which burned down our facility in...
So tell me about this fire.
Our office and our packaging facility on a Saturday afternoon started on fire.
Wow.
Right in the middle of harvest.
Right in the middle of harvest.
Yeah, we weren't done yet. I happen to live on the same 40, and so I was the first one to see the black billowing smoke come out of it. And that was about 3 o'clock on Saturday, and everything was gone. The only thing that was left, and it was such an intense fire, was metal and potatoes. Unbelievable. Well, the potatoes don't burn. They cook. We had plenty of baked potatoes for everybody. But they were kind of smoked, so nobody really wanted them. So that was quite a challenging time, but it was very defining because it gave us the opportunity. It was an old facility. It had 15 roof lines. It started out as a barn. So in all fairness, it wasn't what we were going to be able to expand and grow into. And at that time, Bob Berard had a facility in Bancroft that he wasn't fully utilizing. And so the next day he called us and said, I heard you had a fire. I have something for sale. And within a very short period of time, we were able to put a deal together that was great for him and very good for us. And we're continuing to be partners because of that relationship. And it allowed us to expand and move to Bancroft, which was where the bulk of our farming opportunity was. So it was a very defining moment in our company. It almost broke us. I can tell you that from an insurance standpoint, Jim did a phenomenal job of collecting from an insurance company as a replacement value. However, we had very underinsured for business interruption. So anybody in business, I can highly recommend get a more of a business interruption because I think we had $100,000 and it cost us well over $1.5 million for what we lost, that transition of getting up and started in a new facility within a year. So that was very challenging.
I was in Westfield at the time the fire started, and I got there probably 4:30. I was helping store potatoes. We're right in the middle of harvest. We had 30 loads of potatoes packed, ready to go on Monday morning in the shed. Our competition took the gloves off for 1 week and helped us. We only missed one or two orders is all we missed out of that, all on time. Well, the fire started about 3, 4 o'clock. At 5 o'clock, I turned to them And I said, you guys aren't going to help over here. You need to go figure out what you're going to do on Monday morning. We opened up a shed at 6 o'clock on Monday morning. So it's the grit. It's the when the going gets tough, the tough get going. So it isn't, when he mentions insurance, that's the smallest part of it. So you lost $500,000 on that. You have to save the business. Insurance isn't going to save your business.
So I want to go back to this thread. So you were walking us through kind of 1999, talking about how you tie these together.
So after the fire, that was it got obvious again to us that, okay, we can continue to compete with everybody in the industry and be a supplier and just sell the few customers that we had. And we actually had a long-range planning session that we hired Dick Judy, which I think many of you know from this area. So he was wonderful for us. He really helped us focus on what is it do you want to be, where do you want to get to, and how do you want to get there. At that time, we determined that we wanted to take RPE and create that to be a profit center for us rather than just be our marketing arm. And the goal partly was is that if we could create the revenue value in RPE that the farm, based on a cyclical nature of agriculture, if we could produce the profits that the farm could possibly lose in one of those bad years, at the worst case scenario, we'd break even. And so we had a model of saying, how do we do that so that we can create our company with our other structures, Paragon and RPE, to be able to take that cyclical noise out of farming. And then when you have a good year in ag, boom, you're going to have a great year. And so we really focused hard for the next, realistically today yet still, on how do we create RPE being the market leader in the industry and what does it take to get there?
Does that mean that RPE sells other people's potatoes?
So we sell right now of the Waisaki grown potatoes, only 5% of what RPE sells is Waisaki's. Mm-hmm. So 95% of what we sell is actually outside potatoes throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And that has created us a strong point in the marketing firm. It's a lot because we have direct marketing to our customers and we provide a full category solution for them. So if they need Idaho's, Wisconsin, reds, whites, yellows, Washington, small potatoes, big potatoes, we're basically the solution for them. Mm-hmm. I was always taught my whole life, price, quality, and service, pick any two you want. And what we determined was that really wasn't the case anymore. We lost Supervalu was our biggest account. And one of our competitors out of Idaho, Green Giant, came in and overnight we lost the business and we became a supplier to Green Giant. And the reason was is we weren't providing the two things that they needed was innovation and solutions. And so that was an awakening call for our company saying, how do we do a better job than just selling? And so we created a true marketing team. And we have category management for our customers now. We create all the marketing data that they may need. We create the packaging and the whole throughput that a customer might be looking for. And that's what changed us more than anything else. Understanding that need of our customer created our value back to our growers, along with, you know, to our own farm and our own business.
I created Paragon Farms. And I put together eventually 23 growers, all small growers, and put them into the packing shed. But here's where fairness and trust came in. You realized in our business at that time, and it still happens today, that the farmer would dig the potatoes, put them into our storages, we would decide when to market them and what to sell them for. And we'd maintain and keep them in there. We still do that, only on a different scale. But fairness, I gave what they called pool pricing, where they all received the different categories of their quality, the average price for the whole year. It took the grower completely out of the marketing decision. I need to sell now because my taxes are due or the bank is on my back or something like that. We had to do some innovative things when they made the transition. But you realize in our business, they take their whole crop and put it in our hands. And we sell it, but it's fairness. They get the average price for that for the whole year. In other words, we went into a year-round marketing. They could get, if we had one bad load of potatoes in March, the customer would say, well, I gotta change to Idaho, you know, for the rest of the year anyway. I just changed now. I had just about 8 warehouse full of potatoes one year when the market just dried up for us because of some other things that went on in our area and bad potatoes were going on. We innovated in Wisconsin. We replaced what was known as a repackers by innovating them here in that. What gave me total control at Thanksgiving time, Everybody wants to cook at home on Thanksgiving dinner, a small 10-pound bag sell, small potatoes. In January, all the corporate Christmas parties are being held, and that's all a baked potato. So if you sit here and this farmer wants to sell now and his big potatoes, I couldn't manage the pile that way because I needed to have small potatoes at Thanksgiving time and not be overloaded and have to hold a fire sale on the others. That added value to everybody.
You must be describing Paragon Farms.
How Paragon Farms operated for our growers. So we had a pool of growers of 15 different farms that brought their potatoes to the plant. And in order to have them trust what we were doing is what the pool system allowed, because we treated ourselves the same way we treated them. And therefore, they felt comfortable because we wouldn't treat ourselves poorly. Mm-hmm. And it was fair and it was equal and it was honest. And that allowed us to grow that part of our business and therefore represent their potatoes to the customer.
And the challenging and capital intensive part here is the storage of potatoes, right?
The quality at the time that you want to ship them. So storage is a big piece of that, right? It's the growing and the crop and the production of it, but then also when do you put them away and then when do you take them out?
And so how do you so carefully manage them? Because I can go to the grocery store right now. We're far removed from the growing season and the potatoes are delicious and perfect.
I think it's one of the most least understood parts of agriculture. It's a business today. It is not just farming. It's not just because we love the way of life. It is tremendously scientific. I mean, potatoes are 80% water, and you want to maintain a potato within less than a half a degree change per week. You want to maintain that humidity level at 98%. But the biggest thing is you want to never get below 97. And if you get towards 99, you have moisture and you have rain within the building. And now you have rotting potatoes. So it is tremendously important. You got to watch your CO2. You got to watch your temperature. It is more important to watch those. And it's just like a huge refrigerator that you have to make sure you're taking care of that potato. And it takes a lot more science. And that's why this partnership with Midstate is so exciting, because it's giving now technology that we need and give training to people, because it's not just hard work anymore. And there's a lot more science to it, a lot more IT to it. And the whole part of agriculture is so exciting. In my opinion, it's the new frontier of opportunity.
We've talked a lot about potatoes.
Yep.
What other produce is the Waisaki family of companies involved in?
So we grow all the canning crops, so peas, beans, and sweet corn for the local canners, Del Monte, Seneca, Lakeside, that group. And then we grow field corn, so a lot of grains. We grow field corn, soybeans. We're actually starting to work with kidney beans. Mm-hmm. Kidney beans is the newest one that we just started here a few years ago. And then we have a dairy out in Nakusa. So we're grow the feed crops for the dairy. So we're growing corn, but for corn silage and alfalfa for haylage.
In your produce piece of the puzzle, what percentage of that is potatoes and what percentage is it other?
So traditionally potatoes need at least a 3-year rotation. So every third year you can put potatoes on the same field for disease issues. And the same thing with any crops. You never want to repeat over and over again. So 1/3 of our crops are potatoes, 2/3 of our crop are rotational items.
40% of the corn in the United States is going for ethanol right now. What's going to happen when we're all electric vehicles? How will we respond to that? How will that industry respond?
How would you respond?
You have to look forward to say, where is the market going? You never want to be on the bleeding edge, as they say, but you want to be right next to it, because the first 5 to 8 years of any evolution, you get paid for that variance and everybody else has got to catch up to you in the 10th year and do it anyway. The challenge that we're faced with in Wisconsin right now is that we're very heavily dependent on the canning crops as our competitor to grains, and the canning industry is suffering because everybody's going to frozen foods. Well, the frozen food industry has really gone out west. So that's where most of those plants are built. So it's creating a challenge for us right now to say, where can we find proper crops? So we need to be, as a fiscal policy, as a nation, U.S., we need the cheaper dollar helps us, because then we can export our corn and soybeans to China and other areas at the India where the business is booming. And that's one of the areas that we have to take a look at. New crops, is hemp going to be is an answer? Is marijuana? From our answer, no, we're not interested. But for other areas, they are, right? Those are other crops that are being grown. Climate warming keeps going. Maybe I can grow oranges. Who knows? But right now, it's going to be a challenge from that standpoint. That's why we started a dairy, because we didn't have crops to grow. But if we grew the crops for the dairy, we were then able to create the sale to the milk. And therefore, there was still demand from that standpoint. Plus, it was great for the land, great for the industry, great for the water system. And so that was one of the main reasons why we wanted to create a dairy to be happen.
I think that that's a great example of vertical integration. It's one of the things that we see emblematic of your company, is that you're growing the potatoes, you're storing the potatoes, you're selling the potatoes, all and packing the potatoes, all in one company. What other assets does this vertical integration give you?
It gives you better utilization of your team. Mm-hmm. So, you know, everybody says it, and it's very, very true, right? Your team is your most important asset. And if you can get them to be able to do multiple different areas of responsibilities, it gives you the ability to hire better, pay more, and be able to create them so that they have a full year-round work line. And that's one of the challenging things of agriculture, right? And in a winter time, what do? So by having the systems that we have in place and the expansion that we have, it gives us an ability to utilize that team members throughout the whole year and gives us a full-time workforce.
And that's actually a great example. One of the initiatives that we're working together is workforce training. We have this workforce advancement training grant to upskill some of your seasonal workers so that they can take on other operations throughout the year. Personally, I see this as a commitment to your employees and your community, but also as an investment in your own future workforce. What kind of drove this activity?
Again, it's a cliche, but your people are your most important asset. And what we figured out over the last 5 years is we weren't investing them in as much as we should be. We were taking it for granted that they were always going to be there. And as society has changed and agriculture is less than 1% of the population today, we don't have people graduating or coming out of farms and wanting to go back into farms. So we have to take people from other traits and other businesses and train them into our role. And we want to invest back into them. They want to be invested in. So if we can give them the training and the onboarding that they're looking for, we feel we can bring people in that have interest in biology, have interest in chemistry or ag engineering or regular engineering, and bring them aboard and say, okay, this is something I really enjoy, but teach me how. And we were struggling with being able to do that on site, because it's one of those times when you're on site, you're busy, right? This is the now time. And so with the partnership with Midstate, we're really excited about taking it to the next level, being able to help them get that onboarding, give them that one-on-one personal time that they're looking for to learn. And it's been a great partnership to date, so we're really pleased with how that's going.
Yeah. We've heard smatterings of science and kind of getting into the topic of sustainability and how critical that's been in terms of the production of the crop and the increased quantity, but also safety and health and environment. And so how is the Waisaki Family Companies addressing that?
So from a safety standpoint, again, investing in our team, we have a full-time safety coordinators now, and we're doing fantastic work of there is no such thing as an accident, right? We want to protect them from that standpoint. How do we make sure that we don't have accidents at our workplace? Before, it used to be in farming. Well, that's just part of farming. It doesn't have to be. And we're changing the mindset, changing the culture to bring that safety to the whole team. And it's the last 2 years, we've really focused on it hard. And we're seeing just, I would say, a 40% reduction each year in any injury type cases, which has been great. Food safety is huge, right? As the consumers get more and more concerned, as the customers get bigger, that's one of their biggest issues. So again, we have trained people that are working on food safety, make sure that we're not creating anything in farm side of it with any of our growers. What are we applying? What are we doing? The audits that we're meeting from that standpoint. The sustainability, that would be one of those cutting edge things. And that's one of the things that we're really, really excited about, where we think we're taking Waisaki Farms and RPE and Waisaki Family Companies. Is we had this property that was out in Saratoga. We've been challenged about putting into expanding that into farmland. And we were looking at what should we do with that. And we were able to see the future. My brother Jim did a great job of saying, you know what, I think solar is coming into the area. It's getting cheaper. It's something we should look at. And I'm here to tell you that's not a fast process. It's a 3 to 5 year process in order to create that to come to fruition. And we're really, really proud at the moment that we just announced a partnership with Alliant Energy. And they are putting in 150 megawatt solar farm in Saratoga. And it's something that we're really proud of. And we're talking to our customers. It's definitely what the consumers are looking for. It's what Metro and Kroger are looking for, and the Costco's and the Walmart's. It is on top of mind for everybody. And it's an area that we're really working towards. And we were there first. We were 10 years ago, we started a dairy farm. And the first thing we did was we put in a digester and we produce enough electricity with the methane in order to run 600 homes. And it's something we believe in, and we want to take it to the next level now and say, how deep can we get with sustainability and create that that moment of value to the consumer? The biggest challenge has been the last 10 years is try to define sustainability. And I think we're finally coming to a point where we're saying, this is what we think we can do. The bigger issues, let's take on the solar. Let's see if we can do that. Let's see what we can do with our equipment. Can we convert some of our trucks to solar, not solar, but to compressed methane gas with our digester? So we're researching those things and say, how can we take it to the next level?
It's interesting. One of the critiques of these large solar farms is that they take farmland out of operation. As a farmer who's putting in a large solar farm, how do you counter that argument?
There's production is helping. There's certain farms that are probably in lower productivity. So therefore, by upgrading your land, it maybe makes it better. It's still better for the carbon footprint of America. And can we make that happen? And I think production and technology is going to allow us to make that work just fine. I think they can be symbiotic and work together. I don't think it's going to be an issue.
A planting tractor today has got 7 computer screens in it that monitors the machine behind. It goes, once the operator turns it into a row, it goes down the row by itself within a fraction of an inch of where it went. You can move over half a field and start planting, and when you come back to fill in, it'll be right on the money.
Modern farming methods is something that I think is worth investigating, because these are farms of the future that require a lot of precision. And while we're still talking about sustainability, one of the things that has impressed me is as the farms get larger, we are more precise in how we use water. We're more precise in how we use fertilizers. And so how has that precision affected your impression of sustainability?
So again, that's one of our challenges by our customers. So we're a large Frito-Lay customer, and PepsiCo has got a 2025 goal of reducing water usage by 15%. And so there's multiple different ways you can do that. So we've invested heavily into programs that give us what is our top load into a soil and what is our bottom load? What is the range that we need to farm by? So instead of just going out by the old system of saying it's going to be dry today, grab the soil, see if it's wet, add or subtract, there's now using that same method, because you still have to have it, because it doesn't rain consistently from here all the way to Bancroft. But it's more now on that field, how does it look? And then it gives us guidelines so that we can help manage and train the new people that you keep bringing, that we have to bring in, and say, use this tool as additional track. So therefore, if we can use 5 to 7 and 10% less water because we're using that system and understanding that, it's critical. The second part is increase in production. The best way to use sustainability is if I can take a farmland that's 1 acre or 400 bags an acre and turn it to 500 bags an acre, I just was that much more sustainable, right? Because we got that much more pounds in production off that field. So it's critical to use modern day fertilizer technology and your herbicides, your pesticides, and what are you doing to the minimalist, but at the same token, making sure that you're affecting the crop to give us the most out of it.
So what's next for Waisaki?
I think the sustainability is going to be our next pillar that we're going to work towards. I think it's really critical to the consumers right now. It's expanding into the new varieties and new products to our customers. It's taking it to another level, as Dad says, a collaboration with our customers. It's still a buy sell, but it's getting to be less and less, as there's realistically only 10 retailers in the country that move the volume. I mean, I don't know if everybody, Walmart handles 25% of the produce sold in America. So if you're not selling Walmart, you're down to 75% of availability of customers that you have.
Do you sell to Walmart?
We sell to Walmart, yeah. So we're very fortunate to have, we sell 19 of the top 20 retailers in the country, and we sell all 6 of the top 6 food service operators in right now. So we have a very diverse customer group, which from RPE standpoint has been very, very helpful, and it allows us to, COVID, right, was a tremendous thing for the restaurants, and it just absolutely crushed them, and it really hurt our food service business. But our retail business was strong, and so therefore we were able to transfer a lot of our crops over to there and create that opportunity to still move our responsibility to our growers, which was great. Portage County and Stevens Point area is a wonderful place to be, wonderful place to work. I think we have one of the most diversified workforces here. And what Mid-State and University give us, I think we all take for granted. I get to travel a lot in my job, and I'm here to tell you we have a phenomenal area.
Thank you for listening to Profile, Central Wisconsin. Special thanks to Louis and Russell from the Wysocki family of companies and to Todd Kukan for joining me in this conversation. Profile is a production of Mid-State Technical College out of the Stevens Point campus. To learn more about Mid-State Technical College, go to mstc.edu or follow us on Facebook. If you're looking for ways to add technology to your business, Mid-State has great IT programs, from network specialist to software developer to security specialists. If you were inspired by the story of Wysocki, we also have a new agribusiness program called Agribusiness Agronomy Technician. This 26-credit technical diploma allows you to get started in agribusiness and take manageable steps towards higher credentials. Visit our website to find out more information about all of our programs and activities. To learn more about the Portage County Business Council and everything they're doing to connect and grow our business community, visit portagecountybiz.com. That's biz with a Z. Be sure to subscribe to this podcast on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you consume your audio media. You can also just ask your smart device to play the Profile Central Wisconsin podcast to hear the latest episode. Our podcast page, mstc.edu/podcast, has all the latest information and all the ways to listen. It's the mission of Mid-State Technical College to transform lives through the power of teaching and learning. Help us work toward that goal by sharing this story. Thanks for listening.
You recently were honored by the Potato Grower Magazine. I don't sense you're a guy that's into awards, but how did that make you feel, that honor by the magazine?
I was pretty proud to be right in line with Jack Simplot.
And who's Jack? For those of
he invented the French fry.